Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Our ancestral responsibility to safeguard our watershed and fishery has united all of us in our work to defend the world's last great wild salmon fishery.
Pebble opponents celebrate an EPA decision to ban the mine. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 31st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Matsu school bus drivers go on strike, but not before dropping kids off at school.
That's where the company put us, and they had to push us to the limit to make this happen, so we had to bring attention to it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you an Alaska artist or do you know one? March 1st is the deadline to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. The program provides awards to artists, musicians, performers, writers, and culture bearers. Amounts are increasing. A project award, now $10,000, is available for an Alaska artist at any career stage. Mid-career and established artists may apply for a $25,000 artist fellowship. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. Rasmussen Foundation, promoting a better life for all Alaskans. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced today that it is effectively killing the controversial Pebble Mine project. The Pebble deposit contains a vast store of copper, gold, and molybdenum. The EPA says the mine would cause too much damage to habitat for the world's largest remaining wild salmon runs. KDLG's Izzy Ross reports.
This is a decision that some Bristol Bay tribes have pushed the EPA to take for 13 years. United Tribes of Bristol Bay Executive Director Alana Hurley says it's historic.
Many of those who began this battle are no longer with us. New generations of our people have been born and raised with the cloud of pebble hanging overhead. But our ancestral responsibility to safeguard our watershed and fishery has united all of us in our work to defend the world's last great wild salmon fishery.
The EPA is exercising its rarely used veto authority under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act to prohibit mining the Pebble deposit. This is just the third time in the past 30 years that the federal agency has used that authority. Hurley thanked the Biden administration multiple times during an EPA news conference. She pointed to the administration's nation-to-nation discussions with the region's tribes and said the federal government consulted with them when the state government would not. She also said tribes will continue their efforts to protect the region.
Our work will not be done until every inch of our traditional homelands are protected, and EPA's action today helps us build that future, where our people can remain Yupik, Dena'ina, and Aleutiq for generations to come.
The Pebble Company had proposed building an open-pit copper and gold mine about 17 miles from Iliamna Lake. The EPA says the mine's harm to salmon habitat would be unacceptable. It would damage or destroy 100 miles of streams that support spawning and breeding. It would also damage over 2,000 acres of surrounding wetlands. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied Pebble a federal permit 2 years ago, but the mining company is appealing that decision. Pebble CEO John Shively said in a written response that the EPA's use of its Clean Water Act authority during the appeal process is, quote, unlawful and unprecedented, and that it will likely result in legal action. The EPA's determination goes beyond banning Pebble's proposed project. It also bans future projects that would cause similar damage and restricts the discharge of mining materials in certain waters near the site. EPA Administrator Michael Regan said this decision is focused on the Pebble deposit.
We know that this particular project would have adverse impacts that would significantly impact not only the industry, but also impact the ecosystem and have a significant impact from a cultural standpoint as well.
The EPA Office of Water Assistant Administrator Radhika Fox says the agency's decision means that the Army Corps cannot grant Pebble's appeal as proposed, but she says it does not ban every future project.
it provides a roadmap for those types of projects that would create these adverse impacts, but does not at all apply to other projects that could potentially be considered. And it does not apply to any resource development, beyond this one in the state of Alaska.
The EPA says the habitat around the pebble deposit supports the diversity of Bristol Bay's salmon and many other species, which in turn sustain the region's Alaska Native communities and support its sport and commercial fisheries. In Dillingham, I'm Missy Ross.
Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy says he's going to pursue legal action against the Environmental Protection Agency's veto of the Pebble Mine. On Talk of Alaska today, he called the EPA's final determination a political decision.
It's on state land. We traded land for this particular mineral find. The whole premise of Alaska as a going concern, as an entity, as a sovereign, is that we were to develop our resources. That's the irony of this whole thing.
Alaska's congressional delegation had mixed responses to the announcement. Senator Dan Sullivan said that while he opposed Pebble, the EPA's actions could set a precedent for development on state lands. Senator Lisa Murkowski reiterated her opposition to Pebble, but said she supports mining in the state and that the Biden administration has a responsibility to support other projects. Meanwhile, Representative Mary Peltola supports the EPA's use of its veto authority at the Pebble site. But Dunleavy called the EPA's action a dangerous precedent. He also said it was one in a series of projects that could have provided jobs in Alaska but were struck down.
The irony of a lot of these projects that are trying to be shut down is that they're located in some of the poorest areas of our state. Now, what's the answer for some of those folks that want to develop their resources, whether it's Kakanak, whether it's out of Pedro Bay, Iliamna? What's the alternative for them? A check from the government?
Also on Talk of Alaska, Dunleavy repeated his goal to make Alaska the most pro-life state in the country. But he says he's not directly going after abortion rights. Instead, he's focused on making Alaska a place where people want to live.
You're pro-life if you make Alaska a more inviting place for people to come and want to have families, whether that's better schools, whether that's cheaper housing, cheaper fuel.
Part of the governor's vision for a more inviting Alaska is one that is more food and energy self-sufficient and less at the whims of global supply chain blockages like those seen during the last few years due to the pandemic.
How can we grow things out, for example, near Dillingham? There's actually a farm in Bethel that produces vegetables and other crops for local consumption. And I think going local and helping folks create local economies, local food, local electrical generation is really something that we're going to look at.
Dunleavy's recently announced plan for a carbon sequestration industry in the state is another piece of his self-sufficiency vision. While some lawmakers remain skeptical of the lucrative outcomes the administration has outlined, the governor says carbon sequestration could be a solution to the uncertainty that comes with state revenue being tied to the price of oil. The Dunleavy administration introduced a bill package last week to authorize the Department of Natural Resources to begin managing and marketing a carbon sequestration industry in Alaska. Gas supply from proven fields in Cook Inlet will only be enough to satisfy demand from Alaska's main population center for about 4 more years. That's according to a report from the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas released Friday. The forecast paints an urgent picture of a gas basin that's declining while utilities along the rail belt continue to depend heavily on the natural gas that's produced there. KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports.
The state comes out with a gas inventory report every few years to update the public, including lawmakers, about the status of the fuel that powers Alaska's rail belt from Homer to Fairbanks. And while it's long been known that Cook Inlet's gas supply is in decline, the Division of Oil and Gas in its recent report moved up the date for when that supply will fall short of demand, 2027 instead of 2030, as it predicted in the last forecast. The highly anticipated new forecast comes on the heels of explicit warnings from producer Hillcorp that it might not have adequate natural gas supply for utilities past their current contracts, some which end as early as next year and others which don't expire for over a decade. Utilities like Homer Electric are reliant on Cook Inlet natural gas to meet the vast majority of their energy needs. The forecast does not suggest solutions to the projected shortfall, but details what state engineers and analysts expect out of the inlet, with a few caveats. For one, it doesn't account for how much undiscovered gas there is in the Cook Inlet region in general, but rather when production from known and proven reserves is expected to fall short. While the report assumes demand will stay the same on the rail belt for the foreseeable future, it says after falling behind in 2027, supply will drop to under half of all demand by 2023. That assumes no significant cutback in demand for gas due to renewables and makes no estimate for production from undeveloped gas prospects. Still, there are many other unknowns at play, and the question remains whether companies like Hilcorp will decide if it's worth investing more in the inlet when costs of production for its declining wells are so high. Since Hilcorp's announcement last year, utilities have been meeting to talk about possible solutions that could last them beyond their current contracts. One strategy has been to decrease their reliance on natural gas and introduce more renewable energy projects into their portfolios. But it seems unlikely those projects, many of them in very early stages, could make a dent in local energy demand by 2027. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Team Alaska is racking up the medals at the Arctic Winter Games.
We're proud to represent our state and our country. You just have to be there to feel the energy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Students were stranded at Matanuska Susitna Borough Schools today after school bus drivers dropped them off this morning and went on strike. Teamsters Local 959 has been negotiating with district contractor Durham School Services. Patrick Fitzgerald with the union said members overwhelmingly rejected Durham's last best offer made yesterday.
The authorization, the strike vote, was approved by 98% of our bargaining unit. So we had 98% of a 185-plus member unit vote to strike.
The strike created a major transportation problem in a sprawling school district that enrolls roughly 19,000 students and covers a region about the size of West Virginia. Schools told families they had to pick up their children at the end of the day. Fitzgerald said union leaders made sure students were safely at school this morning before beginning the strike. He said Durham had forced their hand.
We understand that there are, it's frustrating for families and parents who now have to pick their kids up from school. But that's where the company put us, and they had to push us to the limit to make this happen, so we had to bring attention to it.
Durham and Matsu school officials both said they had no advance notice of the strike. Durham said in a statement that, quote, Teamsters 959 made the decision to abandon the students at school and then strike, end quote. According to Durham, the company's final offer included raises of 8 to 14%, a $1,500 bonus, and fully paid weather cancellation days. The company also claimed that the union rejected attempts to bring in federal mediators and that some employees continued to work today despite the strike vote. District officials said they were disappointed by the union's strike. In a message to families this afternoon, they said schools will remain open tomorrow. But they said there will be no buses for all schools except for a few serviced by other companies. And if a child cannot make it to school, they can make up any work they missed. Fitzgerald said the strike will end once Durham provides the union's bargaining unit with an acceptable offer.
We want it to be resolved, but we're willing to go as long as we can for our members to get a fair contract.
Durham's statement made no mention of any other offer being made today. Alaska's governor says he'll appeal a pending federal court ruling that threatens to shut down the Southeast king salmon season. Governor Mike Dunleavy was unequivocal when answering a question from a listener during Alaska Public Media's Talk of Alaska Today. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The Duval, Washington-based Wild Fish Conservancy filed suit against the National Marine Fisheries Service in U.S. District Court in 2019, arguing that a flaw in the agency's environmental analysis left a small population of endangered killer whales in Puget Sound exposed to further harm due to the interception of their primary food source, king salmon, also known as Chinook. In barest terms, the proposed remedy to correct this alleged oversight by NIMS involves shutting down the Southeast Alaska salmon troll fishery until the full impact of the Chinook harvest on southern resident killer whales can be assessed. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game intervened in support of the National Marine Fisheries Service. So did the Alaska Trollers Association. It hasn't gone well. Although a federal judge in 2020 declined to impose an injunction against the Southeast troll fishery, the latest report and recommendation in the U.S. District Court of Western Washington in December 2022 leaves open the possibility that the Wild Fish Conservancy could prevail. If a judge signs off on the recommendation, trolling for king salmon in Southeast might be off limits for 10 months of the year, making the fishery uneconomic and unviable for many trollers. Although the state joined the lawsuit, it's been relatively quiet about the case. No fighting words, at least in public. That changed on Tuesday morning when Juneau troller and four-decade-plus fisherman Tom Fisher posed the question directly to Governor Dunleavy on Alaska Public Media's Talk of Alaska.
My question is, will the state commit all resources necessary to take this court case to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and if necessary, the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Thank you.
The answer is yes, because this is another example of opportunities being curtailed in Alaska. And again, I think we do fisheries better than the feds did when we were a territory. So the answer to that is yes.
We very much appreciate the governor's conviction on pursuing this lawsuit to the end.
Amy Daugherty is the director of the Alaska Trollers Association.
You know, it's just so frivolous and so harmful to all of Southeast and our way of life here. So it's such good news.
Daugherty says her job has changed dramatically since the Wild Fish Conservancy filed suit 3 years ago. The existential threat to Southeast trolling, which is somewhere between 700 and 800 small businesses across the region, has grown as the suit has progressed. She says the issue has not been overhyped.
I think it's extremely valid. It's extremely justified to be very concerned about the current situation. Wild Fish Conservancy has a lot more means, certainly, than the Alaska Trollers Association, and they seem to be applying it with absolute conviction. We are just doing everything we can. We're getting a lot of resolutions. We're getting new money every day, a lot from fishermen, a lot from organizations, processors, stores even. And we're just hopeful that there will be some common sense brought forward through this process.
It's unclear what the immediate impact of a ruling in favor of the Wild Fish Conservancy would have on Southeast trolling, given this newly re-elected governor's interest in fighting the suit to the bitter end. During the same Talk of Alaska, Governor Dunleavy didn't just go to bat for trollers. He reaffirmed a commitment to the industry as a whole and to subsistence harvesters on Alaska's interior river systems, whose way of life is threatened by a still unexplained collapse of king salmon and chum runs.
I would say that this is priority number one when it comes to resources for this administration for the next 4 years. And, you know, missing a fishing season, two or three fishing seasons, has a detrimental effect, not just, as you said, on food, but also on the fact that it's difficult to pass down the ways of life and the culture if you can't bring the kids out to fish camp. And so we're going to do everything we can to turn this around because Alaska is fisheries.
A final decision by the U.S. District Court of Western Washington on the December 13th report and recommendation in the case of the Wild Fish Conservancy versus the National Marine Fisheries Service et al. Is pending. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Time with friends means the world for kids, and the same goes for kids at heart. Connecting with friends and loved ones matters because Alaskans are better together. Boost your power to protect yourself and those around you by keeping up to date on all recommended vaccines, including an annual flu shot, or any boosters recommended by your provider. Visit vaccinate.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The 2023 Arctic Winter Games got underway in Wood Buffalo, Alberta, in a blaze of fireworks Sunday night. Those are the fireworks. More than 2,000 athletes, their coaches, and support teams gathered for opening ceremonies. In all, 7 Arctic nations have come together to compete in winter sports, as well as traditional games from indigenous cultures like the Inuit and Dene. Alice Martin, a Cree elder, gave the blessing. Team Alaska, which represents the United States, has more than 240 athletes from 30 different communities in the competition. They flew to Canada over the weekend in 2 chartered jets. Sarah Frampton, who is the Team Alaska chef, that's French for chief, says she felt a lot of pride as she looked at the Alaska athletes dressed in uniforms of gold and blue, the state colors.
Marching out onto the field for the opening ceremonies is unlike any other experience. We're proud to represent our state and our country. You just have to be there to feel the energy. You see the smiles on those kids' faces, even though they're in, 20 below, they're just grinning from ear to ear. Their toes might be freezing, but they've got a smile on their face.
Frampton says the sub-zero temperatures in Wood Buffalo, Alberta have been a challenge. At one point, it was colder than 4 degrees below zero, the minimum allowed for some outdoor games. So the times for some of those games had to be moved to allow for more sunlight and warmth. At last check, Alaska had racked up 15 ulus. Those are the medals, shaped like the curved knife. 2 of the gold ulu winners, Leah Marie Evans of Homer and Colton James Paul of Kipnuk, have been longtime participants in Native Youth Olympics. Evans is 17 and on the Homer Halibut team. Paul is 18 and says in his biography that he began learning techniques from his brother at the age of 7. Paul says as he competes in Native games, he tries to spread awareness about suicide. Team Alaska also has 4 silver ulus and 9 bronze. The Arctic Winter Games continue through Saturday. Stedman Elementary School in Petersburg is teaching kids about how to save for long-term rewards in the classroom. Kids can earn stickers or fake money, which they can spend on different prizes. One of the big-ticket popular items is a tea party with their principal, Heather Kahn. KFSK's Rachel Cassandra joined a Principal Kahn tea party and has more about what kids are learning by saving up.
Principal Heather Kahn is setting up her tea table during lunchtime. Her office is decorated with notes and drawings from students. She puts out thin bone china cups and a teapot. She's serving hot chocolate today with heaps of marshmallows because she says that's what kids actually want at a tea party. 2 first graders come in, Gavin and Rory, toting lunch boxes.
Excellent. What do we got in our lunches today?
They sit down in the kid-sized chairs. They got hot chocolate, but Kahn pours herself an elderberry tea to boost her immune system during flu season.
Don't forget to put some marshmallows in there.
In first grade, the classrooms use stickers as rewards. Gavin and Rory had to save up for this tea party.
But how do you get a sticker?
By doing a good choice or being good.
What was something that you did?
I did directions quickly.
Ooh, so he followed directions quickly. That's one of the golden rules of the classrooms, huh? Mm-hmm. Follow directions.
Mary Midkiff teaches third grade at the elementary school. She uses laminated paper coins in her classroom.
I tend to pass it out if they're following directions, if they're ready on time, if they take a risk, if they try something new, if they bring their homework in.
Midkiff has heard from families that kids are excited about saving up their pretend money.
Every time the parent was like, oh, I've heard all about it. They've been talking nonstop. They can't wait. And so that's always really positive. You figure when they're going home excited about it, you're doing something right.
Some parents have asked her whether the money system is too much like bribery. But Midkiff says it might be good training for their futures.
It's sort of how the adult world works. Like, we do things we enjoy, but we also get a reward for them. We get paid for our jobs, you know, that sort of thing.
The kids also develop different styles of saving and spending and learn from each other.
Sometimes you get a child who just wants to save it up all year. And then the last week of school, they're like, how many things can I buy this week?
Becky Martin is also a third grade teacher at Stedman Elementary. She was the first to come up with the idea.
What gave me the idea is I watched a little boy counting his stickers one day, and I thought, you know, he's spending a lot of time counting stickers. I wonder if I can turn this into a more academic endeavor.
So she decided to try using fake money as a reward system. With that same student, Martin saw that there was a lot kids could learn about real currency, not just using stickers or points.
When I first used the coins, I traded him 5 pennies for a nickel, and he got quite upset. And I realized he doesn't realize that the 5 pennies do equal the 1 nickel.
The older classrooms use play money with real denominations. Kids trade in 5 pennies for a nickel, 2 nickels for a dime, and so on. Midkiff turned this task into a job for her classroom.
A couple kids, it's their job to be the bankers. It does rotate, and I actually pay them for their classroom jobs, so they get a quarter at the end of the cycle, and then they can apply for another classroom job, so that's another way that they earn money.
Kids save up until they get the ultimate jackpot, a photocopied dollar bill. They can pick from small toy animals to keep at their desk or food-shaped erasers, but Martin says objects aren't the most sought-after rewards.
Although a few go into the treasure chest and get an object, the really popular ones are having tea with Mrs. Kahn, helping in the library, having a special privilege.
Some other special privileges are sitting in a spinny chair during class or bringing your pet to visit the class. Back in her office, Principal Kahn starts to wrap up the tea party.
I'm going to clean the plate now.
There you go.
But I only spill a little bit on the plate.
The plate's great to spill on.
All right. See you later.
Bye. Bye.
In their classrooms, Rory and Gavin can earn more stickers to save up for their next tea party. In Petersburg, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Well, that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Kavitha George, Chris Clint, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Rachel Cassandra in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.